Derek Jensen, author of A Language Older Than Words, joins us again. His book, already in its fourth printing, takes a long, hard look at his wide-ranging experiences to explain violence as a pathology that touches every aspect of our lives, and indeed affects all aspects of life on Earth. Nature, philosophy, domestic abuse, memoir. It is difficult to pin down Derek Jensen's beautifully poetic exploration of the various ways we live in a world from which we have become increasingly estranged. Join in and hear Derek Jensen's remarkable worldview.
All right here, where the eagle meets the condor, now on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and Thursdays at 7 p.m. And look for us at eaglecondor.net. Also, tune in to our new program, Amazon-Life.com, every Monday and Wednesday afternoon at 3 p.m.
Where the eagle meets the condor, a joining of eagle science and technology with condor heart and spirit. For each week, we make known the unknown by bringing to you an interesting guest, a new experience, a different angle on life. Every Wednesday morning from 11 a.m. to noon and Thursday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. on KNRY AM 1240. And we are broadcasting from beautiful historic Cannery Row on the Monterey Peninsula. I'm Nancy Lorenz. Elena Young is my co-host. And Dave is our engineer. So to speak to our guest this hour, the phone number to call is 831-373-1236. That's 831-373-1236. And if you heard the little noise in the background, that's the other way to reach us today with a question, is to send email. And you can send it to spirit@eaglecondor.net.
Wonderful, and we have been waiting for this. We have Derek Jensen with us again. If any of you, all of you out there, followed our advice and got A Language Older Than Words, you will understand why we've been looking forward to speaking to this brilliant thinker again. And I think we have him on the line. Derek, are you on?
Yep, I'm here.
Hi.
Great, welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Derek, since we do have your program archived, when we spoke about A Language Older Than Words, and we barely were able to cover that, I'd like to start today with asking you about the follow-up to that book, The Culture of Make-Believe.
Uh-huh.
And that's going to be released this spring, is it not?
Yes, it's coming out in April.
So what made you write that? What did you think that you left unsaid? Or what was your impetus for writing that?
Well, it was supposed to be a 10-page introduction to an encyclopedia of hate groups. And when I asked the question, how do you define a hate group? The book exploded because if you look at a KKK website, you'll find that they say that they're not a hate group, they're a love group because they love whites. And so what this meant to me was that either you can't trust someone's rhetoric or the KKK is not a hate group. And so if you can't trust somebody's rhetoric, then what can you trust? And so I just started really thinking about this, and I mean, if you go, for example, just by the numbers, then the largest segregationist organization in the country is the judicial and penal system, because it's achieved segregation of black males on a scale that the KKK could only dream about. I mean, there's, what, about 33% of this nation's black males between the ages of 18 and 35 are under criminal justice supervision. And then I just started thinking about what are the forms of hatred that we don't see. Like, for example, if you look under I don't remember the exact legislation, but if you look under federal hate crimes legislation, you'll find that for example, if a man rapes a woman because she's a lesbian, that can be a hate crime. If he rapes her because she's black or because she's dating a Chinese man or any of those reasons, that can be a hate crime. But if a man rapes a woman because she's a woman, that's not a hate crime. And here's another. I'm just going to sort of throw some things out, and then I'll try to bring them together. You know, when a man goes to prison, the first thing that a lot of people think is, oh my gosh, he's going to get raped. You know, it's just like a stock joke on sitcoms. In every prison movie, you know, there's got to be a rape scene. And the interesting thing about the rates at which men are raped in prison is that it's lower than the rate at which women are raped in the culture at large. But we don't talk about that. We don't think about that. And another example would be if I look up the keyword rape on Alta Vista, the single most common type of site that I find is pornography. And you know, it's more common than rape crisis hotlines, you know, rape crisis centers, scholarly articles, histories, anything. And if you go to some of those sites, and we're not even talking about straight porn here, we're talking about, you know, really violent stuff. If you go to some of those sites, you see some amazingly violent images. And I was thinking, so if they were a bunch of black men who were tied up, or if they were a bunch of white men who were tied up with captions like, you know, like the captions for the women might be, make these young sluts do whatever you want, or nasty little breeders. So if you had a caption, make these young bucks do whatever you want, or nasty little breeders blow white men, I mean, the hate watch organizations would be all over these things, but
yeah. They're
not. And so what I really came to pretty quickly was that any hatred that's been felt long enough and deeply enough no longer feels like hatred. It feels like the way things are. It feels like economics. It feels like tradition. It feels like religion, even. It feels like science. And so what I really started exploring is, what are all these forms of hate that we don't talk about? And what are all these forms of atrocity-inducing attitudes that we don't talk about? And one of the things that I get to is that I have a riddle, a couple riddles partway through the book, which are not very funny. Question: what do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and guns? Answer: two life terms for murder, earliest release date, 2026. Another riddle. Question: what do you get when you cross 40 tons of poison, two nation states, a large corporation, and at least 8,000 dead human beings? Answer: retirement with full benefits. And that's Bhopal. And so what I really started getting into is, what's the relationship between, for example, our economic system and atrocities? You know, we're all so worried. We see all these programs on television, you know, Cops and all these movies, Con Air and everything, about how scary criminals are. And I think there's about 16,000 murders in this country every year. And the thing is, there's that many people die of cancer every 2 weeks. And there are that many people die of preventable cancer, I think, every, like, 3 weeks. And so, you know, if we're really interested in public safety, then the people we should be locking up, of course, are the people who are polluting the total environment with all the chemicals. But we're blind to these crimes. Or, and here's another example, is that the average bank robber, I think, makes like, the average armed robber gets like $400 or $500. And the average sentence for armed robbery, I think, is about 9 years. And the average, you know, how much was taken by Neil Bush in the Silverado debacle in the savings and loan scandal. You know, these large-scale scandals. I mean, you know, we're all abuzz about Enron, but that's just business as usual. And, you know, nobody's going to serve hard time there. And if they do, they're going to go to Club Fed or something for 3 months or 9 months. And probably most of the people involved won't even lose their public office. So, you know, why is it that we, you know, perceive some forms of, I mean, so that's really where it starts. And what it ends up being, the way it's sort of a continuation of language, is that language was, for me, language explores, how do I make myself right within this insane culture? And and really sort of trying to separate what's me, what's the culture, where's my craziness, where's the culture's craziness. And then this next book takes it a step beyond that, and it says, okay, let's just really examine how the culture is crazy. How does it work? How does it end up, for example, that the Irish, when they came over in the 19th century, the Irish, Ireland, had a long history of abolitionism. They were proud of saying that no slave had stepped foot on Irish soil since, I think, 1166 or something like that. And yet, when they came over to the States, they very quickly became very strongly... very quickly, they got to the point where one Irishman could say, you know, I would sooner think about killing a hog than I would a black person. I'd think more about killing a hog than I would a black person. You know, there were these huge riots against the free blacks in the United States. So how did that happen? What was it that happened? How did that come to be? So that's the sort of stuff I'm really examining in this. That's part of what I'm examining. And then another thing I'm examining in the new book is that we don't... What I wanted to call the book is The Other Side of Darkness, but my publisher didn't like that, so I got one chapter called that. And what that's really about is that every activist I know goes through this sort of long midnight of the soul where you realize really how bad things are, and you come to the realization that there almost undoubtedly is not going to be a voluntary transformation to a sane, sustainable way of living. That, you know, things are going down, and they're going down hard, and the dominant culture won't stop killing everything on the planet until it undercuts its basis, you know, its ecological basis, and collapses. And so what do you do with that information? How do you... Every activist I know has been able to sort of go through that transformation where you realize that and realize that doesn't kill you, that you can go on, that actually what hurt was more your resistance to feeling the pain. That hurt far more than the pain itself. And it takes a lot of energy to continue to think that... To continue to deny exactly how bad things are. So when you really fully accept how bad things are, and it's a very dangerous and difficult transformation that
you know. Yeah, because you can go crazy with it.
Yeah.
Also, because it is probably the most overwhelming thing that one can realize at this
right.
point. I think your lines of thinking on this are absolutely excellent.
Thank
We're
you.
Sitting here with our mouths open because this is just awesome, the way you are putting all of this together, the double standards that are going on all around in our culture that we're totally blind to. We accept things on one side that are so much worse than things over on this other side that we don't accept.
Well,
it's to have you lay it all out like this is just a phenomenal gift for anyone who wants to, you know, is on the journey for truth.
Well, thank you. We try so hard not to see these things. You know, we really do work very hard not to look at them.
Well, yeah, it is pretty ugly.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned economics is certainly power, and economics are very tied together. But it made me think of something I heard last week that is such an example of that. You know that we have what companies that put out poisonous products, something that is known to cause injury, and the government gives these companies 10 years, 15 years to get them off the shelf because otherwise, or to make any reparation or to stop the pollution because it would be so detrimental financially to the company. And yet, what I heard last week was that the FDA mandated that all products, all oil, hemp oil products, should be taken off the market in 1 month.
Right.
Now, isn't that a bizarre thing? That is a very healthy oil, and
yeah.
and it's it's got to be off the market because it comes from the plant that produces a drug that the FDA calls it, and that has to be done in a month. And the others, because they're big and huge and powerful and make a lot of money, can continue.
It depends on who's paying the decision makers.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I totally agree with that. It kind of makes me laugh at myself and laugh at my friends whenever any of us say, oh, the corporations are taking over the government. Well, the truth is that the government has always been set up. I mean, from the beginning, the purpose of government has been to protect the producers from the outrage of those that they steal resources from. And we keep convincing ourselves that the purpose of government is otherwise. And I don't have the quotes on the tip of my tongue, but I don't know. It's like, oh, shoot, I shouldn't even have brought it up because I can't remember, you know, who said what. I think it's John Locke said that government is set up for no other purpose than for the preservation of property. I think that was John Locke.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's the preservation of the property of those who are rich. I mean, it's, this never counts the people who are not rich.
Well, most people are under the illusion the government is set up to protect us from everything so that we don't have to take any responsibility for ourselves.
That's a really good way to put it. And I think that there are certainly some... on one level, we can say that, but on another level, it doesn't make any sense. And one of the things I think about a lot is with automobiles, for example, that...
Derek?
Yes?
Hold that thought.
Okay.
We're going off to a break, and we'll be back. This is Nancy and Elena with Where the Eagle Meets the Condor with Derek Jensen. We'll be right back. Amazon Rainforest Herbs, discover the treasure. By using the Amazon Herb Company's Rainforest Herbs, you're giving yourself time-tested and proven rainforest phytonutritional ingredients. One informative, interesting, and valuable hour twice a week on Mondays and Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Amazon-Live.com on KNRY AM 1240. Thank you for calling Amazon-Life.com, your resource to the highest concentration of life energy on the planet. How may I help you?
For more information, call 800-551-2933. That's 800-551-2933. Amazon-Life.com. Amazon Rainforest Herbs. With an estimated 100 million consumers spending more than $12 billion a year on dietary supplements and the industry growing at a rate of $1.5 billion per year, the verdict is in. Americans want more than traditional medicine, and they're turning to natural remedies to find relief for their growing list of health concerns. Amazon Herb Company products evolved after John Easterling's discovery during a trip to South America that herbal teas and plants cured his own lifelong health ailments. After supplying these rainforest botanicals solely to healthcare practitioners, Easterling and his staff worked side by side with doctors in several countries, supplementing thousands of patients for over 3 years. They fine-tuned the original formulas and streamlined them down to include a few focused formulas which address today's most pressing health challenges. Now you can experience the treasures of the rainforest by calling 888-551-2933 or browse Amazon-Life.com.
And it's in 3, 2-1.
Where the Eagle Meets the Condor every Thursday evening here on KNRY AM 1240.
Look for us at EagleCondor.net.
Welcome back to Where the Eagle Meets the Condor with Nancy and Elena. Our guest this hour is author Derek Jensen, who wrote A Language Older Than Words, and we're talking about the direction of his newest book coming out in April, The Culture of Make-Believe. And Derek, you were giving us an example about automobiles?
Yeah, I was just going to say that back to the whole incarceration thing, that if, one of the arguments that's made for locking people up is that we're keeping our streets safe. But it's really interesting that they mention streets in these contexts because, if there were some aliens from outer space came down and said, okay, we will give you this technology that will that will make it so you can move from one place quickly to another, and we'll do all sorts of other, bring you goodies like tomatoes in January. But on the other hand, what we want in exchange for this is a sacrifice of 500,000 people a year, and 42,000 of those would be Americans. And we want you to change your climate, and we want you to devote something like, 5% or 2% of your land to these machines that we're going to give you. I would hope that we would go, that's a terrible deal. There's more teenagers. We all got so excited about the 14 high schoolers who died at Littleton, mm-hmm. but there are more kids than that die every afternoon in the United States from car wrecks. And we're so worried about gangbangers in the inner city. But Jan Lundberg, who's the person who turned me on to these stats in the first place, points out that if you take automobile accidents into account, it's actually statistically just as dangerous to live in the suburbs. And so once again, we don't perceive these things. And as you know from talking to me before, perception is something that I've always been, I'm just so interested in why it is that we see something and why we don't. I can ramble on this for a second, unless if you've got another question.
Please, no, do. Perception is like the key to our freedom and understanding, I think, and you do wonderfully at showing us the contrast or whatever.
Well, thank you. One of the people that I talked to several years ago, I interviewed him for the magazine The Sun, and then I included a little bit of that conversation in here, is George Gerbner, who is the, whenever anybody cites the statistics on television violence, they're citing studies that he's been doing since the 1950s. But the interesting thing is that all they ever cite is the figures, and then they don't ever talk about his conclusions, which are not particularly that television makes us more violent. He's much more interested, first, in the fact that television creates what he would call a mean world syndrome, which is that it makes you much more fearful and timid, actually, because it makes you perceive that the world is a much more violent place than it is. Because, right now, I could go on and turn on the television and, I could see lots of murders. But you know what? I've lived 41 years, and I have never in my whole life seen a murder. I've seen very few actual fights. And it's not to say that there aren't people who have witnessed a lot of murders, but the world is not nearly so violent place as it's presented to us. And then the other thing that he's really interested in is how do minorities become minorities? And what happens is they get, it's like the Scottish balladeer said if I could write the ballots, I wouldn't have to write the laws. And he said it much better than that. But basically, what that is if you can tell the stories, then you can really teach people how to live. And one of the things that Gerbner's always been really interested in is who, he says, violence is not a simple act. Instead, there are multiple people. And he's not against all violence, by the way. He says it's an important dramatic tool. But what he's really interested in, who does what to whom. And what he's found is that in programs, men are generally, men have carte blanche to do violence. And he says, for example, if you have a woman in a movie who is violent, the whole movie has to be, how did she get to be this way? As opposed to, you know, you get Bruce Willis in a movie, you know he's going to blow somebody away by the end. And as opposed to, give me a big actor. Oh, Julia Roberts, you know? Get Julia Roberts in a movie. If she kills somebody, that's a shock.
Yeah.
And so we have to figure out why.
Well,
and what
she has
that does,
to be crazy. If it's a woman, she has to be mentally deranged in order to commit those acts, right?
Exactly. As opposed to Bruce Willis, he just has to be a guy.
Yeah, those guys do that all the time.
Yeah. So it's how we get trained into these things, or how, I mean, one of the things that I'm writing another book right now, and one of the things I'm saying in that, one of the things I say, is that every writer is a propagandist. And the most important parts of propaganda, and I mentioned this in culture too, but it's more, I'm going to develop it more in the new book, that one of the central points of propaganda is if you can get people to accept your assumptions, especially if you don't state them, then you got them. It's like it was said of Hitler that from monstrous premise to, from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, he was coldly, icily logical. So if you accept the premises, then he's got you. And it's the same with a lot of our stuff, that if you accept the premises that, okay, so they say on the nightly news that the economy, it's great, the economy is growing. Okay, first presumption, that's great that the economy is growing, but they stated that one. Okay, what about the fact that we have an industrial economy? I mean, it's all subsumed in there. What about, you know, it's like all these premises can go into that, and that's one of the things I really try to do with my own writing and with the whole culture at large, is to try to look at what are these unquestioned assumptions. There's this great line, I don't remember who it's by, I read it 15 years ago or so, unquestioned assumptions are the real foundations of any culture.
Yeah.
I love
that's
that.
Terrific. Yeah.
And so one of the things I try to do is to shine light on as many of those in my own life. You know, why is it that you know, I get upset at this? Well, okay, let's look. This is a question I ask myself with every sentence. As I write it, I say, okay, is this sentence, is this really what I think? And then I ask myself, so why do I think this?
That's excellent, because the same thing works on an individual level as well as in society.
Right.
If more people did it, it would really work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean the assumption part of it that goes on in us, and Derek is exceptional because he's looking at it.
Yeah.
Society doesn't look at it as a whole. It's not in the media. It's, you know, it's the whole illusion keeps being perpetuated.
Well, yes, and so in the middle of the new book, The Culture Make-Believe, in the middle of the book, I explore pornography for about a chapter. Not the overtly violent stuff, but just, you know, regular depictions of naked women. And it's a pretty complex thing. I'm really proud of the section I wrote on that. I think it's some of the best writing I've ever done. It's one of the best takes on porn that I've seen.
Wow, we look forward to it.
Oh, thanks. And one of the things I realized, so in order to write this, of course, I visited a bunch of sites for maybe a month. And one of the things I found that was really disturbing to me was that I found it was, and this is kind of embarrassing to admit, but it's, you know, it's, I mean, I say it in the books, I may as well say it here, that it affected my spontaneous fantasy life. So historically, you know, I'd be walking down the street, and if I see a woman, I was interested in her, whatever that means, I might think, I would immediately, for my whole life, my fantasies would run to, so what would it be like to have a really great conversation with her about, you know, what would it take to, you know, to take down civilization? Mm-hmm. And, you know, to have this intense conversation, that's where my fantasy life would run. But after only a month of looking at porn, sooner actually, you know, I'd walk down the street and I would see some woman and I would picture her naked. And it was so striking to me what this did to my spontaneous is the key word here. You know, what
right,
it did.
The instant first thing that comes up.
Yes.
Yes.
And so I was thinking, if that happened so quickly with something that is so obviously objectifying as porn, how about for all these things that are much more subtle?
Oh, perfect, exactly.
Jeez, yes.
You know, day after day, the stock market goes up, down, you know, we're supposed to care. Day after day, we hear that you know, every day in school, I pledge allegiance to the flag. I mean, that's a pretty obvious one, too. But, you know, all these ways that we are taught how to perceive. There's this great line from a Canadian lumberman that says, when I look at a tree, I see dollar bills. And, I mean, that's the same thing as,
right.
You know, when I look at a woman, I see an object for my sex, you know? It's all analogous. And so what I got at in language, this is one of the things that's a theme that runs through both of these, is really sort of attacking this utilitarian worldview that how can I use something? I mean, that's really what it boils down to. Because that was another pretty interesting thing that I'm sorry that I'm jumping. Well, you're seeing why all my books again are written in linear fashion. and I wanted to tell you something else too. I'm putting together a CD, and actually I'm almost done with it.
Is that the stand-up tragedy?
Yes.
Great.
That's a heart-wrenching title, by the way. Especially, it would not have been. But I read a language older than words before you mentioned that to me, and it is heartbreaking.
Yeah, and I need to give credit. I mean, I love that title, but actually I didn't come up with it. Somebody at one of my talks did, and just at the end of the talk, because my talks are just filled with jokes, and the guy said, you know what you do stand-up tragedy.
Mm.
Okay,
when
now
is
that
the
I've
CD
said all that, I've forgotten
available?
Where I was going in the first place. Okay, we were talking about porn. What did we talk about right after that? Perception, how it changed perception. Oh, shoot.
Well, the fascinating thing is what you saw just a month of that, how it changed your spontaneous thinking. And I think most people are not aware of the influences like this that happen to us. And it's not just a lot of people don't look at the porn, but the marketing is everywhere.
Oh, it's the same deal, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
To be honest, I have, respect is probably the wrong word, but I probably have more respect for honest-to-goodness pornography than I do for advertising that uses women, because at least the porn is honest about what it is.
Yeah.
I remember what I was going to say. I was going to sort of jump subjects, too. So early in the book, I started examining, and this is how I really got into the whole question of economics, is I thought one of the things I would do early on is if you're going to find something that's based on hate, slavery would be pretty top of the list. And so I did a pretty thorough examination of the rationale that was used, the rationales, five of them really, that were used to support slavery in the pre-Civil War American South. And the interesting thing is that none of them were based on hatred at all. That one of the arguments, and I don't need to go through all five, but one of the arguments was religious, that, you know, it's all through the Bible, and if it's good enough for Noah and all them, then it's good enough for me. And another one was economic, that basically our economy would collapse without it. And another one was scientific, philanthropic, which is we're actually doing them a favor. We're civilizing them by, you know, and we're bringing them out of their slothful ways, you know, that they would sit around doing nothing. And so we're teaching them the benefits of labor. And the thing I wanted to point out about that is that none of this was really, there was no hatred involved anywhere, really. I mean, on the upper level, the most conscious level. And And then another thing that I came to right after that is that before the Civil War, there were not many lynchings. And after the Civil War, of course, then there were tremendous numbers. There were uncountable numbers of American black people in the American South were killed. And what the difference is, I realized, is that there's this line by Nietzsche that one does not hate when one can despise. And do we need to stop?
Yeah, we are actually heading into another break there, Derek. So thank you for, we'll pause you right there.
Okay, great.
This is Where the Eagle Meets the Condor with Nancy and Elena. We're speaking to author Derek Jensen. We'll be right back after this. Why keep managing your health the old way with expensive store-bought supplements when you can discover a new level of life experience? See for yourself the difference Rainforest phytonutrients can make in your life. No additives, no fillers. Simply nutrient-rich Rainforest herbs. Feel the difference. Call 888-551-2933.
Thank you for calling Amazon-Life.com, your resource to the highest concentration of life energy on the planet. How may I help you?
There's your source. Call 888-551-2933, Amazon-Life.com, Amazon Rainforest Herbs.
We're back to Where the Eagle Meets the Condor, and we're speaking with Derek Jensen, author of The Magnificent, A Language Older Than Words. We are speaking about the transition to the new book, The Culture of Make-Believe, which will be available in April. And before we go back to talking about that, Derek, you do have, here's an opportunity for our listeners to send you an email and buy an autographed copy for the regular price of $16 postpaid, huh?
Uh-huh.
All right. That is great. And you mentioned on, I found this on your website, that I thought the same thing. You thought that books were just reshelved and yet they're pulped. And Context Books has allowed you to pick up those books instead of having that, right?
Yeah, that was a real shock to me, that when a book is sent to a bookstore, this part wasn't a shock. I knew this because my sister worked in a bookstore years ago, but when a book is sent to a bookstore, if they can't sell it, then they can send it back to the warehouse, and that's not a big deal. But what I discovered was that, I didn't discover, what I was told, was that sometimes those books are just sent to the warehouse and then sent back out, but quite often it's cheaper for the publisher simply to pulp them when they go back. And that's
really, I don't understand that. I don't understand how it can be cheaper in the first place, and that's sacrilege.
yeah, that's my first book was called Listening to the Land, which is being republished this spring also through Context. And the publisher for that
was the Sierra Club, right?
Yeah, and it was a pretty horrible thing because they published about 7,000 copies, and they told me in the end that they only sold like 3,000, which I'm not sure I believe. But anyway, let's say that's true. They only sold 3,000. So I said, well, I would like to buy, you know, a bunch of those remaining ones, and I'll just sell them myself. And they said, we only have 70 left. And I said, what are you talking about? This either, you, that means you owe me a bunch more in royalties. And they said no, we pulped all the remainder were pulped.
Oh, terrible.
So they pulped more than half of the books.
That had to be a shock.
Yeah, and especially, you know, from Sierra Club that's supposed to be environmental. It's a crazy thing. I don't understand that at all.
But anyway, here's an opportunity for everyone to receive an autographed copy, and it is such a magnificent book. It was difficult, very difficult to read, because Derek, as I told you when we spoke last, I am just awed that you remain sane, that you have grown so much, that you have used everything that you discovered, everything you researched and found, which is horrific, to say nothing of what you experienced, and you have just done magnificent things with it, and we just applaud you for that, because that is quite an accomplishment. But you also make it very easy for us to learn, because if we've been too lazy to research and open our eyes to see what's going on in the world, you've laid it out very beautifully. So
thank you for saying that.
People will take this opportunity and get that would
then
be good.
And also, for the benefit of our listeners, they can find Derek on our website, eaglecondor.net, and also Derek's website is derekjensen.org, and it's J-E-N-S-E-N. And there they can find the email link if they wish to contact you, Derek?
Uh-huh.
Okay, great.
Oh, and one other thing we might spell is D-E-R-R-I-C-K.
Two R's, yes, okay. DERRICKJENSEN.org. And if you can't write that down or remember, just eaglecondor.net and look for him on our guest list there.
And an email that just came in is a request to hear more about the CD. Where is that available? Is it available now, etc.? So,
well, I'm glad to have that opportunity to talk about it. I'm laughing because I was just going to say, hey, I would like to pump the CD for a second. So, well, yeah, what you don't know is I secretly sent that CD.
No, you didn't. I can tell where it came from.
the CD is, I'm actually, it's kind of crazy because I'm actually producing, let's see, what is me? I was a writer, performer, director, sound engineer, mixer. So, I mean, I'm doing the whole thing. It's actually turning out pretty well. I should be done with it in about another. I'm hoping to be done with it in another week, and then send it out to get actually, you know, mass produced. And for now, I'm going to distribute it for myself, and then I will, or distribute it by myself, and then I will also. My publisher will probably take it over maybe in about 6 months. But for now, if somebody's interested in it, they should send me an email. And it's going to be a double CD. One CD is my talks, and the other CD will be sort of a best of Q&A from a bunch of them. I don't know if you know this, but I tour so much. I tour constantly.
Yes, you have a whole list of sites there, of dates, on your website. People can look at that. And also here, I'll say, too, that you and I have been speaking about this. At some point when you're touring around here, we will have you, maybe we'll do something where we can have people attend. We are thinking of a master's dialogue.
I would love that.
And that would be great, because then people have the opportunity to talk to you.
Well, that would be fun. Yeah. The thing will be, well, I'm going to set up. I just got a note yesterday from a bookstore in San Francisco that wants me to come back. I came there last year, and so at some point I'll set up a Bay Area tour and maybe a Bay Area / LA tour, and then I can certainly do that in between or something. That would be
great.
That would be fun.
Yeah, let us know. We'll promote that, too, and we'll go to that.
Is there anything else you'd like to know about the CD? I mean, I sort of talked about that really quickly. Is there anything else? I don't know what to say about it.
I don't know what to ask you about. This is a talk, right? The CD is on a talk that you did.
One of them is, it's kind of the, I'm choosing a bunch of from a bunch of different talks.
Okay.
Where, you know, in one talk, this part of the talk might have been really good, but then in another part, I forgot to, you know, I forgot this and this and this, or just didn't work or something. And so I take that part from another talk, and it's kind of fun, because I'm kind of playing this, you know, like the whole, I mean, it's kind of like putting out a rock album, you know, live rock album or something. I mean, I'm having gas with it.
That's great. Anyway, if people can send you email, and that can be done through our website or your website,
uh-huh.
So that is good. So, now that your wish was granted about that so nicely, let's continue with is there something that you want to tell our audience about a language older than words? Because this is a morning audience, and we have, the last time we spoke to you was on an evening talk. So is there anything there that that's particular that you want to, why people should...
Maybe just describe it a little bit if you can.
How can you describe it? I tried. I couldn't.
Okay. Well, that book really began as I wanted to write a book about interspecies communication, but I realized pretty quickly that I was onto something deeper, which is that before you can exploit somebody, you have to silence them. And so that book is really about the way that women, children, other races, other species, our own histories, our consciences are all silenced. And what I do in that book is I use my own... My father was extremely violent, presumably still is. I haven't had contact with him for years. But, I mean, he beat my siblings. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He broke my sister's arm. And, I mean, he's extremely violent and also sexually violent. I mean, he raped my mother, my sister, and me. And so I use that experience of being separated from my emotions, from my experience, I use that as a springboard to talk about the larger dynamics within the culture on how we do all this crazy stuff. And, you know, I try to move back and forth, I think pretty as seamlessly as I can, between how these things trick out on a personal or familial level and how they trick out on the larger level. And one of the questions, I've heard it said, and I don't know if I said this last time, but one of the things that somebody said to me years ago was that for most people, a couple questions drive their lives, and those questions are usually established pretty early. And for me, the question that I had when I was a child is, if my father's behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing it? And that's really one of the questions that drives my life, is this question of, you know, if the destruction that we see around us isn't making us happy, why are we doing it? So that's really what I try to get at in language. And as I said, language is a much more personal book. I mean, make-believe, obviously, if I'm talking about my spontaneous fantasy life, it's pretty personal, too. But it's not the same. I mean, language was in some ways a memoir, and make-believe isn't. Make-believe is, you know, I'm like a dog on a scent. You know, I get this scent, and I'm just, I got this tangle of threads in front of me that I try to untangle. But language was more, like I said, more, the central theme running through language was my own story of disconnection as a child and then reconnecting as an adult, and how I went through that, how I became reconnected.
And that's incredible too, because of how it seemed to have created a way for you to be able to cope with the truth and have the courage to look at it.
Well,
whereas most people can't, we don't want to know.
But here's the thing that is so wonderful about Derek's books, and that is that if we are to really comprehend quantum physics now and the spirituality that's been spoken about, not religion, but spirituality, then having people like you, Derek, and if we all look at that and don't turn away, then perhaps we can affect what is going to happen. Otherwise, it is going to go downhill even faster.
Well, one of the things that I need to say is, when I was saying earlier that the dominant culture civilization won't... I mean, there's a great line from Stanley Diamond that says, a civilization originates in conquest abroad and repression at home. And that's one of the things that I come to at the end of culture is that, you know, is that so long as the framing conditions remain in place, people were going to have this sort of mass hatred. I mean, we have a culture that's based on competition. And any time you have a culture based on competition, you're going to have people at each other's throats, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to have people and perceiving the world as a giant ribbon of cooperation. And so recognizing that civilization, you know, is not going to change course doesn't mean one of the things it does is that, at least for me and for my friends, one of the things it's done is it's freed us up to have different hopes that I hope, for example, that the salmon survive, and I hope that the grizzly bear survive.
Yes.
That's a different hope.
And next month, maybe, Derek, we can have you on again because we're out of time.
Well, that would be fun.
And thank you so much for being with us. The thought that we had for today suits you. You learn from all things that are in your way. You learn and overcome and are better for all things, from Ramsa. And that's what you have done.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Talk to you later.
All right, Derek, thanks.
Thanks. Bye.
And this has been Where the Eagle Meets the Condor with Nancy and Elena and author Derek Jensen today. So tune in next time and be well.